The Beatitudes are some of the most powerful and lasting words ever spoken. For two millennia, they've inspired poets, prophets, mystics, and revolutionaries. But what do they really mean? How have people throughout history understood these paradoxical blessings? And what might they say to us today? Join Sycamore Creek for an 8-week series exploring how the Beatitudes have been interpreted and lived across the centuries. Ancient words, timeless hope, and a world in need of blessing.
I like to network in several different places. I network in the arts community, I network in the justice community, I network also in the business community. And in all of these places, especially the arts community and the business community, I am often the only pastor in the room. That's not to say that there aren't other people in ministry in the room or that there aren't people who are pastors bivocationally, but I'm the only one who's usually there like as a pastor. Like my name tag says Tom Arthur, pastor of Sycamore Creek. And I was at a business meeting recently that the Chamber of Commerce was putting on, and I was sitting at a table. It was a visioning day. We were like looking at what do we envision for the economic landscape of the Lansing region. And I was sitting at the table with an owner of a very well-known business here in Lansing. If I said the name of the business, you would know exactly the business. You've shopped there, you've bought stuff there. And this business owner was telling me about how hard it has been to keep staff. They don't really want to work. They don't want to show up on time. When they don't like what you tell them to do, they just quit and leave. And as I'm listening to all of this, I had this tension coming up in my mind. Like, again, I'm not there as a businessman. I'm there, well, just as a member of the community. But I think a lot about people who struggle at the bottom rungs of society. And so I thought, do I speak up and talk about what that experience is like from perhaps his employees' perspectives? I suspect I'm not alone in this, that there's two warring motivations inside of me. There's the motivation of wanting to speak up, but there's also the motivation of wanting to fit in, to be liked, to be accepted. I don't want to be labeled and left out. I don't want to be cast aside. I don't want to be canceled from whatever group, from that thinks that I don't fit in anymore. The problem that all of us struggle with is we want to fit in. We don't want to stick out. We don't want to be accused. We don't want to be called out and made to look like we don't belong. Now, I'm going to bring that like inner tension today, or that inner motivation, into conversation or into tension with the last of Jesus' Beatitudes. He says this: "Blessed are those who are persecuted for righteousness' sake. Blessed are you when people insult you, persecute you, and falsely say all kinds of evil against you because of me. Rejoice and be glad, because great is your reward in heaven. For in the same way they persecuted the prophets who were before you." How can we possibly feel blessed or fortunate, or how could anybody congratulate us when we feel mocked or reviled? That's the paradox of this statement of blessing that Jesus ends with in a list of 10 paradoxical statements of blessing. All right, we like to stop in the middle of our message, give you a chance to reflect on what we're talking about. So if you're watching this live, turn to a neighbor. If you're at home, put your answer to this question in the comments. When have you stayed silent or backed down because you feared what others would say? Or when have you found your voice and spoken up? Let's talk about it. Today we're wrapping up a series called Paradoxical Blessings. It's the eighth episode in basically a two-month exploration of Jesus' most famous teaching, the Sermon on the Mount, or at least the beginning of it, the Beatitudes. We've been using a book called Beatitudes Through the Ages by Professor Rebecca Eklund. And in that book, she explores the historical interpretation of the Beatitudes over the centuries. And we find that Christians haven't always agreed on how to understand or interpret these opening lines of Jesus' sermon. The last of these Beatitudes is, well, it's a ringer. It's like punches you right in the gut. And here's what Jesus says. Blessed are those who are persecuted for righteousness' sake. Jesus doesn't bless persecution in general. He blesses persecution for righteousness' sake, or on account of him. That righteousness is often misunderstood. Righteousness doesn't mean being right. It means loving rightly. Let me say that again. Righteousness doesn't mean being right. It means loving rightly. It means doing the just and loving thing, even when it costs you something. Righteousness means doing what God considers righteous. It means doing the things that God loves. It means loving the things that God loves. It means paying attention to the poor, those on the margins. It means being aware of who's being pushed to the edge and making sure that they're well taken care of. It means refusing to participate in injustice. Now, right after this, Jesus adds this. You are the salt of the earth. You are the light of the world. A town built on a hill cannot be hidden. Rebecca Eklund says, Jesus' followers must be prepared to suffer such persecution precisely because they are the salt of the world and the light of the world. I want to take a look at an example in history and in scripture of what this might look like. I want to introduce you to Perpetua and Felicity, who chose death over denial. Perpetua was a noblewoman, and she had just given birth. And Felicity was her servant who was pregnant. Now, at this season in the life of the Roman Empire, it was considered illegal to be a Christian. And so they were forced to, well, renounce their faith or their belief in Jesus, or be thrown into the Colosseum and die with the wild beasts. Perpetua's father came to the prison with her child in his arms, and he pleaded for her. He pleaded for her, for the sake of her daughter, to renounce her faith. Felicity gave birth to her child just days before she was eventually executed. At the amphitheater, they faced wild beasts and the sword. Their courage and their calm in the face of death, well, it shocked the Roman Empire, and it sent waves throughout the whole area. They died as witnesses. That's literally what the word martyr means in Greek. It means witnesses. They died of witnesses, not just to Jesus, but of a sort of radical equality. Perpetua was a nobleman, and she was friends with Felicity, who was her servant. They stood beside each other. Perpetua was likely white, and Felicity was likely of North African descent. In themselves and their relationship, they undercut a lot of the inequality that existed in the Roman Empire. Their story was preserved in the Passion of Saints, one of the oldest known Christian texts written partly by a woman. Perpetua herself kept a diary while she was imprisoned. But being persecuted isn't a command, it's a consequence. The real test is how we respond. Origen of Alexandria in the 3rd century and Simeon the new theologian in the 10th century and many others taught that we were to respond to persecution with mercy, gentleness, and kindness, and love. Persecution is a test of what's really inside. Is love inside, or is vengeance inside? When you experience the pressure of persecution, what's really in there comes out. Embracing persecution is a way to experience the divine. And Perpetua and Felicity passed that test. Another who passed that test is Martin Luther King Jr. He saw the Beatitude fulfilled in the struggle for civil rights in the 1960s in the United States. He wrote this, "We shall match your capacity to inflict suffering by our capacity to endure suffering. We will meet your physical force with soul force. Do to us what you will, and we shall continue to love you." Those are words that we need to hear again today in our current culture, our current tensions, the streams that we swim in. So let me read them again. "We shall match your capacity to inflict suffering by our capacity to endure suffering. We will meet your physical force with soul force. Do to us what you will, and we shall continue to love you." I took a class on Martin Luther King Jr. And his preaching while I was in seminary. I suspect, like me at the time, most of you have not read much, if anything, that he wrote. He was a preacher and a theologian before he was a civil rights leader, and I read a good portion of his sermons. In fact, you can listen to them. There are audio recordings of him. Most of us only know little snippets of his "I Have a Dream" speech. So let me unpack some of, kind of the major thread that finds its way through all of his writings and all of his preaching. It's a vision of the beloved community. It's a vision of community where everyone is thriving, where there has been repair and reconciliation, where people who were once enemies are now friends. It was because of that vision that he adopted Gandhi's methods of active nonviolent resistance. Now let's unpack that just for a minute. It was active. It wasn't passive. You were doing something. It was nonviolent. It was peaceful protest. It was, as we heard, the willingness to even receive violence. The people who participated with Martin Luther King, they practiced. They practiced ahead of time, responding to threats and triggering events with nonviolence. It was nonviolent because he wanted to maintain as much as possible with him the possibility for friendship with those who were currently his enemies. It was active, not passive. It was not violent. It was nonviolent. And it changed our world. I want to go back to a basic idea that we're having. It's kind of the foundation of a good portion of this message, and it's this. Righteousness doesn't mean being right. It means loving rightly. All right, let's stop for a minute, give you a chance to write your answer in the chat or turn to a neighbor and answer this question. When you have been criticized or even persecuted for standing up for what is right, do you respond with mercy, humility, and love? Or are you tempted to respond in another less loving way? Let's talk about it. All right, we're unpacking what Jesus meant when he said, "Blessed are those who are persecuted for righteousness' sake." And what I want to do now is I want to turn our attention to three practices. Practices that are, I think, blessings in the midst of persecution. The first one is, examine the source of your suffering. Are you being persecuted for righteousness' sake, for standing up or speaking on behalf of the just in a loving way? Or are you being persecuted just for being loud? Now, there's a lot of people who call themselves Christians who claim all kinds of persecution, that I'd like them to claim a little less persecution. And yet there are still people who, they really are persecuted. And that's what Jesus is talking about here. Rebecca Eklund says, "Not all suffering counts. It is possible to be reviled, not for righteousness, but for being loud, obnoxious, or self-righteous. Sometimes we confuse hostility earned by belligerence with being persecuted for righteousness' sake. There's a fine line between being a prophetic voice and being a jackass. Lately, one of my favorite guys on Instagram is Ryan Dunlap. He's a conflict expert. He was a hostage negotiator. And listen to what he says here about being direct versus being rude.
Can I offer some clarity between rudeness and directness? Because I think some people are confused on this. Too often, we treat rudeness as if it exists in absolute terms. So something is either rude or it isn't. It actually operates on a Likert scale, not a binary switch, right? So on one end, you have rudeness, which is abrasive, dismissive, and contemptuous. And then all the way over here, you have placation, which is overly soft, avoidant, and insincere. Decency sits in the middle. It's where honesty is paired with consideration. Not too harsh, not too soft. There's balance. It delivers truth in a way that doesn't distort reality, but also doesn't destroy people. All right, so yes, rudeness is subjective, but it is not entirely arbitrary. There are some clear differences we can observe. Rudeness is indifferent to impact. So even when clarity could have been achieved with less harm, rudeness adds insult to injury. Directness prioritizes clarity over comfort. So it's not too harsh and it's not too soft. Now, in order to do this, two things must happen. Direct communicators must recognize that their words can be perceived as rude, and therefore they must measure their mouths. The truth can hurt, but the truth teller should not. Now, listeners must recognize that discomfort is not disrespect. And if the truth hurts, that does not mean that the speaker was being rude. You have to lower your resistance. If we fail to make this distinction, we risk creating a culture where truth is either too sharp to be received or too soft to be useful. And neither extreme serves us well.
I love that. There's a way to be direct and there's a way to be rude. Let's talk for a minute about being online. Here's a couple of practical tips for how you can be direct without being rude online. First of all, ask some clarifying questions. I almost never hear anybody on Facebook respond with a sort of active listening strategy saying, what I hear you saying is this. Is that what you're saying? Recently, I was in a conversation with someone on my kids' school Facebook page where we were having a disagreement, and I got to a point where I thought I understood what she was trying to say. So I asked her, is this what you're trying to say? And she said, no, that's not what I'm trying to say. Now that was really good information because I was arguing or potentially arguing with her about something that she wasn't trying to, well, say. Here's another tip. Let the email sit for 24 hours. In fact, in the meantime, send that email to a safe person, somebody that's not involved in the situation, somebody who is not easily triggered, somebody whose like temperament is like Pastor Mark Opperly. After you let that email set for 24 hours, look back over it. Take out all those zingers. Something I've been doing lately is putting stuff like that into ChatGPT and asking it to give me some feedback on what are things that might, instead of accomplishing what I'm trying to accomplish in the letter or email, work against me. Here's a third tip for being online. Record a voice memo instead of typing your answer out. It's so easy to read things into just text that aren't really there. But when you send and like include your voice and the tenor of your voice and all of the nonverbal verbal stuff, there's a way that that disarms. And I'm not saying to send a video, because I think in some ways, like the audio, like when we videotape ourselves, we get all stiff. But when we just record audio, we allow our hearts to be heard. One last tip for engaging online is agree with something before you disagree. I know sometimes that's hard, but if your real goal is to build a bridge or to eventually have that person to come around to understanding you better and your perspective, you're gonna accomplish that, I think, more likely If you start with somewhere, even if it's just the smallest little bit that you can agree with, there's a reason why I call these practices, or why they're called practices, is because it takes practice. You don't get it right the first time. You don't get it right the second time, or the third time, or the fourth time, or the fifth time, or like, you gotta just keep practicing it, and you get a little better each time. 1%, 1%, 1%. Eventually you're 50% better, and someday you're 100% better than you were at each of these practices. Something I've been wrestling with lately is how not to do anti-racism work in a racist way. A racist way says, I'm superior than you. A racist way says, your perspective and your values don't matter, only mine do. A racist way uses violence and intimidation and power to silence a perspective that's different than yours. Anti-racism listens. It woos. It leads with love. So be persecuted for righteousness' sake, for justice and love, not for being a jerk. All right, so we've been looking at this first practice. Examine the source of your suffering. The second practice is practice righteousness even when it costs you. Speak up for the persecuted. Speak up for justice. Speak up for love, even when it costs you something. Some things it might cost you are, well, stress with your family. In those moments, I think about another part of Jesus' teaching in the Gospel of Matthew when he says this, "Don't imagine that I came to bring peace to the earth. I came not to bring peace, but a sword. I've come to set a man against his father, a daughter against her mother, and a daughter-in-law against her mother-in-law. Your enemies will be right in your own household." Oh my gosh. Like, I don't know, I wrestle with that and Jesus saying that. But I think at its core, Jesus saying, listen, like, if you follow me, there's not always going to be harmony inside of your family. Standing up for what's right, it might cost you having stress in your family. It might cost you some tension in your friendships. It might cost you losing a promotion. It might cost you your comfort. But remember, you don't have to do it all. You don't have to stand up for every single thing. In fact, my experience of people who stand up for every single thing is that they're kind of jerks about it. Pick one thing and learn to do that well. Go deep in that one thing. Lately, because immigration has been so forefront in our cultural conversation, I've started to go deeper into that one thing. How do we as a church respond? How do I as an individual respond to the challenges of immigration and our current administration's policies around immigration? Well, one thing that I do is I go back to the Bible and I look at how the Bible responds, or how the Bible talks about how we should respond to foreigners who live among us. And here's what it says. Do not take advantage of foreigners who live among you in your land. Treat them like native-born Israelites and love them as you love yourself. Remember that you were once foreigners living in the land of Egypt. I am the Lord your God. Perhaps if God was saying that today to us through Moses, God might be saying, listen, remember, you were once immigrants too, at least those of us who are white. You were once foreigners in a foreign land. And those people, at least in the way that we tell the story, they welcomed you. They welcomed us, European Americans, and they treated us well. And then we treated them poorly. All right, we've been looking at some practices that I think are blessed when we're faced with persecution. The first was examine the source of your suffering. The second was practice righteousness even when it costs you. And the third is respond to mistreatment with mercy. We're called to rejoice and be glad, not retaliate. Rejoice and be glad, because great is your reward in heaven, Jesus says. For in the same way, they persecuted the prophets who were before you. What does it take to be able to do this. It takes a lot of self-care. It takes a lot of prayer. It takes a lot of confession when you get it wrong. It takes having a community of people who are willing to do this with you so that you're doing it as a team. And again, it takes practice and practice and practice and practice. Rebecca Eklund says, persecution is the final beatitude because it requires all the others to bear it well. It's the last one in the order because you gotta work on all the other ones before you can get to this one and be blessed. So let's take a moment. Let's walk back through and let's remember where we've been through this whole series. Blessed are the poor in spirit, for theirs is the kingdom of heaven. You're blessed when you have a spiritual humility and when you stand with those who are literally poor. Blessed are those who mourn, for they will be comforted. We're blessed when we mourn our own imperfections, our own imperfect love. And we're blessed when we mourn the challenges and the injustices in this world. Blessed are the meek, for they will inherit the earth. You're blessed when you use your anger for purpose and to do good, rather than to tear people or things down. Blessed are those who hunger and thirst for righteousness, for they will be filled. You're blessed when you hunger for the things that God hungers for love and justice, for thriving and flourishing of all. Blessed are the merciful, for they will be shown mercy. You're blessed when the merciful measure you use is the merciful measure that you receive. Blessed are the pure in heart, for they will see God. You're blessed when you have a single-minded devotion, a single-minded love, an all-consuming flame of fire and passion for God and God alone. Blessed are the peacemakers, for they will be called children of God. You're blessed when you don't just try to keep peace by avoiding conflict, but you're blessed when you actively try to engage those who you are in conflict with, looking for a way to love everyone. And blessed are those who are persecuted because of righteousness, for theirs is the kingdom of heaven. Imagine a church where we were all doing this together. I think it's a church that would stand with the vulnerable. It's a church where you could come and know that no matter where you've been or what you've done or who you are or what your political affiliation was, that you're going to encounter an open embrace and inclusion that invites you to grow in perfecting your love, your single-minded devotion to God and loving those around you. Now, this would happen in small ways, like the ways that we interact one-on-one, but it also happened in big ways. The things that we're involved with as a community, both in our immediate neighborhoods, our immediate community, our city, but also in our region, our country, like the whole entire world. A community like this would bear the torch of perpetual infelicity and would continue to carry the torch of Martin Luther King Jr., who was persecuted for righteousness' sake. Let's go back to that business meeting I was sitting in. I was visioning for what does the business and economic landscape look like in Lansing? And in the midst of my own internal struggles about wanting to fit in and not wanting to be called out, I girded my loins. I grabbed my bootstraps. I prayed for the Spirit to give me wisdom and power and love as I spoke about something that is dear to my heart. And I asked the businessman, could I share with you the perspective that I've heard from people who are in those entry-level jobs? One of the things that's a challenge for folks at that economic level is the simple accessibility of affordable housing. Affordable housing is only affordable when you have a living wage. The minimum wage in Michigan is $12.48. That's $2,000 a month. A cashier at Walmart makes between $15 and $16 an hour, just a little over the Michigan minimum wage. Now, the minimum wage is not a wage that is sufficient to actually live on. That's called a living wage. And a living wage is a wage that will allow you to have housing, food, clothing, insurance, transportation, the basics. I'm not talking about like fancy vacations to Cancun. I'm just talking about the basics. And you can find, if you search for living wage, you can find living wage calculators that will tell you exactly what a living wage is in your region. And here's what a living wage looks like in Lansing. A Lansing living wage for one adult with no kids is $20.12 an hour. That's $3,200 a month. That's just one adult with no kids. But most of us, like, that's not how our households work. So what's a living wage for more people? A living wage for two adults with two kids is $23.60 an hour. And when you multiply that by the two people working, it comes out to $7,552 a month. A Walmart supervisor earns $23 an hour. But as we all know, there are more entry-level cashier jobs at Walmart than there are supervisor positions. Everybody would have to be a supervisor, but there aren't that many supervisor jobs. Now, when we look at the rent in Lansing, a one-bedroom apartment on average costs $1,000 a month. This is the average. And that doesn't mean that there are a lot of these kind of apartments actually available. A three-bedroom apartment on average costs $1,500 a month. Now, once again, that's on average. That may not be an apartment that you want to actually live in with your family. And it's not necessarily that there are a lot of those available. Now, I didn't bring all these details and all of the numbers into the conversation with this businessman, although I could have looked him up real easy online. But I did share with him this perspective from perhaps the people who were at his entry-level jobs. And as far as I can tell, I didn't actually hurt my relationship with him. In fact, I think I gained some respect. Now, maybe for you, it's not going deep into affordable housing or deep into minimum wage versus living wage. But I think in some level, each one of us is called as followers of Jesus to go deep into some area to advocate for the righteousness of something, of like the loving rightly of our society for all people. What is it for you? All right, we're gonna stop for a moment. We're gonna wrap this whole thing up with a chance for you to reflect on and answer this question. What's one small way you can practice bold love this week, even if it's unpopular? Let's talk about it.